The prophet Elijah has always been one of my top-level heroes. I love who he is. I love his message. I love his demeanor. I love the way he deals with Ahab and Jezebel on most occasions. He's a tremendous man. But one interesting thing about God telling us about great people is he tells us the whole story. He doesn't leave anything out. And I think that's what we find in chapter 19 of 1 Kings. But before we get to that, let's just do a brief reference to chapter 18. Chapter 18 is very much like a blockbuster movie. When you look at how the whole thing is set up, the good guy wins, the bad guys get what's coming to them, victory is achieved, the people return to God, everything is going very well. The picture that you see on the screen this morning is a statue that stands near the area where this great showdown on Mount Carmel took place. And if you'll notice here, whomever this sculptor was, I don't think Elijah actually posed for it, so whoever is sculpting this is giving us the idea, and I think captures it pretty well. Now, for our younger viewers, I cut off the bottom part of this where all the heads are laying there at his feet that depict how he was able to come with great victory over the prophets of Baal. You would think that after an event like this, the prophet Elijah would be on the top of his game. Here is a man who witnesses God in full action. Here is a man who is a vessel of God. The evil prophets have been defeated. Yet, when we turn the page in our Bibles to chapter 19, what we find is the darkest period of Elijah's life. Here is a time when God is not sugarcoating things, when God lets us see the raw nerve that's opened up by all of the events that are going to transpire afterwards. And this morning, that's what I'd like for us to talk about. So, what goes on between chapters 18 and 19? The last thing we read is the prophet Elijah being given this miraculous ability to outrun a chariot. The drought's over. He takes off running. He beats Ahab back to the city. Things are looking very good. And yet, what we find is that there's a new day, but there's the same old story. And to understand this, we might have to do a little bit of speculating as to what's going on in Elijah's mind. What might Elijah have expected after this great victory on Mount Carmel? Well, I can't say that for certainty, but thinking as most of us would think, I suspect that Elijah thought maybe the people were finally going to rise up against idolatry. After all, they had just said, the Lord, He is God. Jehovah, if you'll notice the word there, is God. And so maybe he thinks, here is the time when this group of people is finally going to get it right. And perhaps he thought that these people, as they got it right, would finally stand up to the wickedness in the palace. Because what we have as we look at this section of the scripture is that Queen Jezebel is pretty much running Israel at this point. Ahab is the king, but he is her puppet. He's doing what she tells him to do. And so maybe Elijah thinks that the people are finally going to stand up. They're going to get rid of the Baals. They're going to overthrow Jezebel. They're going to get rid of Ahab. And a good monarchy can finally come in. Yet, what do we find? Well, as we look in chapter 19, this is what Jezebel told a messenger to go and tell Elijah. So may the gods do to me and more also if I do not make your life as the life of one of them by this time tomorrow. So here's Jezebel, totally unfazed by what's gone on. In fact, if she was fazed by it, it's made her a little meaner, hasn't it? Her prophets, her hand-selected group that worshiped the God that she imported into Israel, they've been killed, and the price is going to be paid for that, and Elijah is the one who's going to pay it. So, evil is still firmly in place. The wicked queen is undeterred by the events that had transpired. And so what does Elijah do? Well, it's here we've got to compare a couple of translations. If you're looking in the more modern translations, it's going to read something like this in verse 3. Then he was afraid, and he rose and ran for his life and came to Beersheba, which belongs to Judah, and left his servants there. If you're reading this out of the King James and perhaps the New King James, it's going to say, and when he saw that, he rose and went for his life and came to Beersheba. So here we've got two ideas. One stating that the prophet was terrified. He was afraid by what had gone on. The other makes it appear more like he's surveying the situation. He's looking over what's taken place, and that's when he goes for his life. So the reaction is one of the two. Either he's fearing, or he didn't want Jezebel claiming a victory. I don't know which is the correct one. You can read a lot about them. But here's one thing that we do know, that whichever it is, things are not like he wanted them to be. Whether he is scared of her, or whether he is looking this over and just kind of throwing up his hands in the air and saying, I'm not going to allow this woman to take me as I've taken these others. What we know for certainty is that nothing in Israel had changed. It was a new day. But it was the exact same story. Now, what I'd like for us to do throughout the course of the lesson this morning is to kind of follow dual screens here, to look and see what's going on with Elijah, but to also understand that there's a reason God has put this account in the Scripture. It's not just to tell us about Elijah. It's to show us what can happen to people who are on his side. Because there are many times that we can have the exact same feeling when we're facing trials. And I hazard to say that every Christian of any age in this room knows exactly what I'm talking about here. Maybe there's been an occasion in your life where you have been in sin, where you've been doing things wrong, and you decide, I'm going to make a change. Today is the day. And you pray about it, or perhaps you confess that to others, or you ask someone's forgiveness, and things look like they're going to be different, and you get up the next morning, and the day looks just like the day before. For some, maybe that even happens after baptism. The great thrill and enthusiasm and excitement that you have on that day you're buried with Christ, you go to bed that night, you get up the next morning, there's the same temptation. There's the same problem. And so what we're seeing is that while our situation in specifics might not be exactly like Elijah's, we can go through similar things. We can have those times when we think things ought to be different, but they keep on with the status quo, and that can get us down just as it did this man. So what happens? When Elijah surveys the situation, he decides it's time to get out of town. And so he takes off. Here in chapter 18, he was outrunning the chariot of Ahab. Here in chapter 19, he's trying to outrun the henchmen of Jezebel. And so he takes off, and as he does this, there's three things that I want us to pay attention to within his story, kind of impacting his attitude. And the first of those was he's acting on impulse here. Here he's got this message from Jezebel that she's going to kill him. And so it appears without giving that a great deal of thought, he takes off and he's running away from her. And so here is the first thing he thinks to do. I'm just going to get away from these problems. I'm just going to get away from these things that are happening to me. And so by impulse, he takes off south, going as far as he can to get away from this queen and her husband to try to protect his own life. But now let's pay attention to what's going on in this impulsive act. If you look in verse 4 of chapter 19, it says, he himself went a day's journey into the wilderness and came and sat down under a broom tree. And he asked that he might die, saying, it is enough now, O Lord, take away my life, for I am no better than my father's. Listen to what he's saying here. We oftentimes pay attention to where he's asking God to take his life. But we need to look at the whole statement. He says, when I'm surveying the history of Israel, what I see is I am making no difference than those who came before me. Which implies what? That he thought he could make a difference, that he thought he could make a change. And after he witnesses the same old story going on, and he sits down and he says, I'm worthless, I'm useless to God, I can't do anything that others have done. He felt himself to be a failure. And thus, with all of this in mind, he's saying, I'm no different than the fathers. I'm no different than those who have come before me. Now, as you consider that, are there not times that we're confronted with very similar things? That as we're looking at something in our lives, that we kind of have this same attitude. It might not produce this scenario where we're asking God to take our life, or maybe it does. But we look and we say, things are just no different and I can't make any different. We kind of like Elijah say, I was going to do what nobody else could do. And then I find I can't. I see this a great deal of time with young men who are preaching the gospel. If you will notice, there is a huge turnover rate of young men who set out to preach and then they give up on it. Well, one of the reasons is they set these undue expectations. Here is a church and they say, we want you to come preach for us. And this church has been dead for 40 years. And the young man comes in and he says, I'm going to turn things around. I'm going to make a difference here. And he finds out he can't. He finds out that no one man can undo 40 years of apathy and deadness. And what happens? He gets discouraged. He says, I'm just like these other guys who've tried. I don't know why I'm going to continue on. So I'm just going to quit. That's the story of many young men. But yet, don't we see that in other things as well? We see people who set out and say, I'm going to make a difference. I'm going to change things. And then when things don't go like they expect, they're ready to quit. They're ready to give up. And so this discouragement grows. The desired outcome fails. And here we find ourselves, in a sense, sitting under the broom tree with Elijah, thinking ourselves unworthy to continue on because we can't make that difference. That's what impulsiveness can do to us. The idea of not taking time to think things through, to understand that we've got to look at situations and their fullness and their complexity and not run at the first sign of trouble. How many marriages would be saved if that attitude were the case? That rather than running away from the problems, couples hunkered down and they got it right. How many relationships within churches could be changed if brethren would sit down together and talk rather than running? You see, there's a reason this account's here for us. Impulse is usually not our friend. But there's a second thing that we see within his life here, and that's isolation. As Elijah surveyed the situation, he ran from it, but he ran all by himself. Did you notice that in verse 3? That even he left his servant behind? So here he had carried his servant part of the way, but then he says, I'm going all the way on my own. I don't want anybody else around. What's interesting as we continue reading in the next few verses is that God allowed that to happen. Look with me beginning in verse 5. He lay down and slept under a broom tree, and behold, an angel touched him and said to him, rise and eat. And he looked, and behold, there was at his head a cake baked and hot stones and a jar of water. And he ate and drank and lay down again. And the angel of the Lord again a second time came to him a second time and touched him and said, arise and eat, for the journey is too great for you. Then he arose and ate and drank, and went in the strength of that food 40 days and 40 nights to Horeb, the mount of God. You ever paid attention to that? So here's Elijah. He's on the run. He's ready to die. He goes to sleep. An angel punches him, says, eat this. So Elijah does. Angel punches him again and says, get up and get going. God is allowing Elijah not only to run, but to run alone and to go even further than perhaps he had expected for this very reason, because God knew he really wasn't alone. God was there with him. And that's the point that we're building to here, that God is wanting Elijah to see that while no one is around him, he's not by himself, that God is there. And what a lesson that is for us. That when we feel isolated, that God is going to listen just as he did to Elijah. There is a time when you and I need friends around us There's a time when we need people we can just talk to and deal with situations, but there is also a time when we need to get rid of everybody else and to pour our hearts out to God. That is exactly what Elijah's doing here. This great prophet who had had this great victory now finds himself in perhaps the darkest time of his life, and the thing he needs to do is to be separated from everybody else except for God. And God knows this. And so God is taking him back to a pretty important place in Israel's history so that he can show Elijah what he needs to see. And God's going to listen to us also. Now, Elijah acted on impulse, and he isolated himself. There's a third thing we need to see in this runaway from Jezebel, and that's that he acted in ignorance. As we look at this account, what Elijah is going to do is to demonstrate his disappointment with both God and man. That as Elijah is playing through this scene, as surely he did, he's going to show how that he thinks everybody's failed him. Everybody has let him down. Let's look at this specifically from verse 10. Notice what he says about himself here. He says, "I have been very jealous for the Lord." But now let's look and see what he says about everybody else and God. He says, "I have been very jealous for the Lord, the God of hosts, for the people of Israel have forsaken your covenant, thrown down your altars, killed your prophets with the sword, and I, even I only, am left, and they seek my life to take it away." Who's the only good guy in this statement? Well, it's Elijah. "I'm the one who stood up for the Lord. I have been jealous. I have done it all by myself. But these people who are now trying to kill me have forsaken God. And God, oh, by the way, do you not realize they've broken your covenants and your altars and your prophets?" That's oftentimes what trouble does to us. It kind of creates this inner focus on ourselves that we're the only good guy standing. And here is a prophet of God showing himself to be the only one who's won in this situation when God hasn't even stood up for himself, much less the people who are trying to do all of this. What is so interesting to me is God's actions as a result of this statement. So here's Elijah. He pours out his disappointment. And so we look at verse 11. God says to him, "Go out and stand on the mount before the Lord. And behold, the Lord passed by, and a great and strong wind tore the mountains and broke in pieces the rocks before the Lord. But the Lord was not in the wind. And after the wind, an earthquake. But the Lord was not in the earthquake. And after the earthquake, a fire. But the Lord was not in the fire. And after the fire, a sound of a low whisper." So here, you've got Elijah kind of surveying this situation, and you see the rocks crashing down, and the earth is quaking, and the wind is blowing, and a fire's coming through. God is saying to Elijah, "Let me remind you who I am." But the point he's seeking to make is, "I have got things under control, Elijah. Do you think if I could tear these mountains apart? Do you think if I can make the earthquake? Do you think that if I can create this strong and mighty wind that I can't take care of this little wicked queen sitting up in the palace thinking she's somebody when she's nobody? And yet you think that I'm the one who's struggling here?" And I believe the implication is God saying to Elijah, "You should know this. You just witnessed me create a fire that drunk up the water. You just witnessed me giving you the ability to destroy over 400 prophets of this false god, and you're doubting me?" And so God follows with a question. "Why are you here, Elijah? Why are we in this situation? What's going on here?" However, Elijah doesn't quite get it. Because look in verse 14. Once again, What does he say? Well, it's a replication of what we found earlier in verse 10. I have been very jealous for the Lord, the God of hosts. For the people of Israel have forsaken your covenant, thrown down your altars, killed your prophets with the sword, and I only am left, and they seek my life to take it away. Elijah has just witnessed three times over the power of God right before his eyes, but he's still not getting it. And so God, once again, is going to tell him a thing or two. But I want you to notice what God says. God says, Elijah, you are not by yourself. 7,000 people have not bowed their knee to Baal. But look at what problems can do. Problems can give us such tunnel vision that we convince ourselves with the devil's urging, nobody understands what's going on in my life. Nobody's ever experienced it. Here is Elijah doing the exact same thing. And God says, Elijah, 7,000 people have not bowed their knee to that false god. And the rest of it, Elijah, is not really your concern. I'm going to deal with it. As you and I look at that, how many times do we see ourselves showing a very similar ignorance to that? We look at where we are. So maybe here I am, and there is this sin that is just plaguing me every day. And I pray, and I say, God, you can change this situation. You can make it where I'm not falling into this temptation. Or maybe here's this person who's just the thorn in my side, and I pray about it, and I pray, well, Lord, maybe I can get a new job, or maybe this guy's going to move across the country, or whatever. And the next day, the situation's exactly the same. And so I look at God, and I pray to God, and nothing happens. And then somebody says to me, well, you're just not trusting God enough. God's big and powerful and mighty and can do anything. You just got to have faith. And so I read my Bible and I see these great miracles and I see how He saves people's lives and how He changes situations. And then I look at myself and I see a God who at the very best simply appears indifferent to what I'm praying about. Because it's the same thing on a new day. That's what Elijah's doing. And let me tell you, if a man as great and mighty and powerful as Elijah can succumb to such reasoning, I had better not say it can't happen to me. So what happens? With all this going on, what is God going to say to this man? Is He going to scold him and say, Elijah, you're a horrible man. I've worked with you. I'm going to strike you down just like you want. Nothing of the sort. God allows Elijah to go through all of this and then to go through it a second time. And God says, okay, first of all, Elijah, I'm not going to kill you like you asked me to. You said, take my life. That's not going to happen. Instead, here's what I want. Look at verse 15. Go return on your way to the wilderness of Damascus, and when you arrive, you shall anoint Hazael to be king over Syria. And Jehu, the son of Nimshi, you shall anoint to be king over Israel. And Elisha, the son of Shaphat, you shall anoint to be prophet in your place. And the one who escapes from the sword of Hazael shall Jehu put to death. And the one who escapes from the sword of Jehu shall Elisha put to death. Yet, and here's what we referenced earlier, I will leave 7,000 in Israel, all the knees that have not bowed to Baal and every mouth that has not kissed him. God says, Elijah, I've got a plan and I've got people in place to accomplish this plan, so get up and get busy. And that's exactly what Elijah does. And what we see after this is a return back to that bastion of faith that we had seen earlier. So if that's what worked in this situation for Elijah, what do I need to see about me? If Elijah listened and obeyed, then I need to understand that's a pretty good formula for me. that there are times when I need to pour out my feelings to God, pour out my frustrations, tell God how I think He's let me down, tell God how I think others have let me down. Let Him hear what's in my mind, on my heart, and then get back to work. To look at the things God has given me as one of His servants to do. Build up my brethren, encourage my brethren, teach the lost, take care of those in need, all these things. And to get busy doing it. Every good book is going to end with an epilogue. So let's end this story with an epilogue also. Oh, by the way, Ahab dies the death of a disguised coward. In a chariot, garbed in the attire of a common soldier, thinking he can hide from the Lord's anger, a random arrow pierces his armor, and he dies. Wicked Queen Jezebel is pushed out of a window by her eunuchs, is ridden over by chariots and horses, and is eaten by dogs. And the prophet who sat under a broom tree saying, "It is enough, Lord, take my life," doesn't experience death as we know it. God rewards him by letting chariots of fire come and a whirlwind lift him up into heaven. And all those people over whom Elijah was fretting, they were brought into judgment for open rebellion against God. Does God know how to take care of the situation? When people are not being very kind to me, can God handle that on His own? Yes. When a problem in my life looks like it's too big for me to handle, can God help me through it? Yes. Here's what we've got to know, though. God's ways are not always readily apparent. Sometimes it looks like God has completely forgotten about me, that He's gotten busy somewhere over in Asia and I'm not even in the purview anymore. God does not always work as I think He ought to. But God will win. When it looks like the situation is as dire as it can be, God is going to win. Now, He may let darkness go on for a while. He may allow problems to go for a while. God's going to win. And what I need to understand is He's not going to abandon the faithful. I'm not always going to see His answer. I'm not always going to be privy to the roadmap He's going to take me to get to where I need to be. The destination may not always be where I think it ought to be. But God's not going to abandon me. Is there going to be trouble? Yes. Are there going to be problems? Yes. Am I ever going to feel dejected? Yes. Am I ever going to feel like things are just going downhill so quickly? Yes. But God's faithful. And God is going to get me to where I need to be. And that's with Him, if I'm willing to stay with Him. I am so glad that God does not sugarcoat things in the Bible. For these people who look so mighty and strong, for God to open the curtains up and to show us that they struggle just like every one of us struggles. Because it gives us the opportunity to understand, A, we're all human. We all grapple with the same things, but B, God can save. And that's certainly what this account shows. Maybe today you're dealing with a problem of that nature. I hope this helps. But maybe today you're dealing with an even bigger problem, and that's the fact that you're not on God's side. God has made provision. When everything looked hopeless, when we were enemies of God, He gave His Son for us. And through the atoning blood of His Son, you and I can find salvation. But that comes in trusting God, believing in His grace, and trusting that in the waters of baptism, my sins will be washed away. And when I trust Him with that, God says, "You will be raised up clean and pure on my side now and ready for the help that I so lovingly want to offer." If you're a Christian and there's a problem that's plaguing you, let's pray about it this morning. If there's something that's just troubling you, one of those temptations every day, let's pray about it. If there's something that you're needing to seek the Lord's forgiveness concerning and you'd like for us to pray with you about that, we'll do it also. whatever it takes, let's trust God at His Word. That even though we can't always see how He's acting, we can trust that it's always in our eternal best interest. That eternally speaking, everything will work out for good.